from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Sloane Crosley's essay collections, I Was Told There'd Be Cake and How Did You Get This Number, have been bestsellers, with I Was Told There'd Be Cake being a finalist for the 2009 Thurber Prize for American Humor. OSU student Kevin Bauer, the CEO of the OSU student group 8th Floor Improv, recently talked to Sloane about her writing, the way in which she chooses her travel destinations, and why she knows the names of media outlets in every U.S. city. Stay tuned.
I've noticed that in addition to the different essay collections and like the publishing work you've done, you've also done a lot of journalistic and investigative writing.
Yes, well, not too much investigative. I mean, basically, I've asked people questions and they've given me the answers. I haven't had any withholding.
Well, that's investigation.
But journalism nonetheless, yes.
So how do you approach that as opposed to like when you put out an essay collection?
There's definitely something that goes on that's sort of intangible in the brain that's almost hard to talk about when you know something's going into a book versus an article, which sounds like a sort of longer euphemism explanation for you don't try as hard as you would with a book, but it's just more, it's so much more pinpointed and directed, and it feels less like you're creating something for an audience and more like it feels incredibly specific, which the essays feel like on a sort of minute level. I'm never one to shy away from an obscure reference that, you know, I'm just going to sort of shut my eyes and hold my nose and dive in and hope that somebody gets it or enough people get it within the essays. But the topics tend to be things that are more universal. And I feel like when I'm interviewing someone or doing something sort of, you know, I write for the Times or I have a column for like the Independent in the UK, and I think the thing you're referring to probably is I just interviewed the Strokes for Spin, and I wasn't trying to think, you know, what's the sort of larger humanitarian story with the Strokes, just what's their larger story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. How do you like the journalistic writing as opposed to the other kind of writing you do?
You know, it's funny, the essays, I found both with I Was Told There'd Be Cake and with How Did You Get This Number that this is probably not a very good thing, but the thing I like best is ending things. That's probably why I write essays, because you can have, you know, the average book has one ending. I have 10, which maybe says something terrible about my personality. But I think with journalism, it's just sort of a different approach. I'm less focused on that or try to articulate it. The dirty secret here is that I've totally lost my train of thought and I forgot your question. And that is why I will never eat a pineapple again.
Are you currently eating a pineapple?
No.
Oh.
See? Everyone always asks about, you know, the sort of, you know, what's true, what's not, what's fudged in the essays, and now you know I'm a big fat liar because there's not even a pineapple in the house.
Oh, God, everything is fake.
Everything. I don't know what to believe.
On the same kind of note as the journalistic writing, I noticed that you graduated from Connecticut College with a degree in creative writing. While you were in college, did you write entirely for classwork, or did you write a lot on the side as well?
Oh my gosh, oddly, a little compliment, I guess. No one has ever asked me this, which is weird. It's either really, so it's a great question, or it's really obvious and everyone skipped it. I actually did. I wrote a column for my school newspaper, which was called, quite creatively, The Connecticut College Voice. Which is also interesting because the first paper I really wrote for with any regularity in New York was The Village Voice, so it felt comfortable, I guess, at least in name. But we used to have these recycling signs around campus that said how to dispose of your waste responsibly. So I saw one at one point. It was in a bathroom, which is kind of a funny place to read that. And so I titled this column I wrote for the Connecticut College Voice, How to Dispose of Your Waste Responsibly. And I wrote some columns, which, thank God, this is before the internet. I don't think you can get them.
You're not proud of the work that you had in your formative years, or?
I am proud of it. You can see in the sort of silent biography everyone writes of their life every day, you can sort of see the seeds of what might have been something that I would later be proud of, I guess. It doesn't necessarily mean it's good writing or that I'd want it shared. The other thing is that obviously the essay format has been around for quite some time, as has the column format. And you know, there's, I mean, you look at like Joan Didion or A. Gill in the UK. There's, you can go back a little further to, you know, Dickens and Swift and all that stuff. But I think that at the time I started doing this, between, let's say, the late 90s and like 2005, 2006, aside from Megan Dahl, there weren't many women specifically writing personal essays. Now it seems like there are a lot, which is actually a very good thing. There was like Joan Didion, Sarah Vowell, Megan Dahl, and that was it. You know, and it doesn't even matter what you think of those people in terms of saying them in the same breath, just the concept that you could think of them is not good. And so I think there wasn't a real format for it. So this is a long way of answering your question about the column for the newspaper sort of felt, I didn't know where I was going. There was no direction. There was no audience for it. I was sort of just trying to talk to people and hope they'd listen.
So you're kind of, you were trailblazing for your time.
Yeah, for Connecticut College. I don't mean for the world. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that unclear?
Oh, no.
I don't mean trailblazing for the universe. I just think for that specific thing, there just wasn't much of it. So, like, one day, I'm trying to put a more fine point on it. You know, one column was about finding a seat in the cafeteria and a sort of don't you just hate it when... kind of call about people putting, you know, just their IDs and their jackets to save seats while they went on the food line, and how dare they, and what counts as an object that would save a booth and what wouldn't. Or another one that was just like a completely made up story about, you know, having some sort of fictional affair with the dean, you know, and you're like, and they had nothing to do with each other. You know, there wasn't any sort of regularity or personality that shone through. It was just sort of ramblings that were not news. I guess that's the thing. It was more of a reaction to what it wasn't than what it was. It was not the arts coverage, and it wasn't campus news. I haven't thought about this in so long. It's funny. Sorry.
No, that's all right. But that is, even if it isn't trailblazing for the whole world, I still feel like that is really important. And do you feel like the freedom that you had then helped to kind of help you find your voice later on?
I think when you're growing up, you want a skill. It's something you want. And I think that, I don't know if that's, you know, I'm going to start to sound like I'm 80 years old and like sort of deriding people for, you know, just wanting to be famous or just wanting to be like sort of abstractly an artist without actually having anything they really want to say. And so for me, this is always still, I mean, I do love what I do, but it still feels like I would trade it in a heartbeat for being an astronaut, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like there's something where, you know, the idea of freedom, it feels more like you were backed into this thing. And then what's great about it is for the first few years, you know, when I was writing either for The Voice or writing, you know, a book review here or, you know, a music review there or stuff like that, or even both voices, both my college one and the actual one in real time, I think I thought that these were, you know, this isn't real. Like, what I'm writing is not really actually of value. It's just what I can do. And then I started to realize how much I loved it and how quickly it came and how much I loved working on it and editing it and what I could say and what I could do with it. And instead of being backed into it, I sort of fell in love with it. I guess you would say, therefore, that, like, narrative nonfiction for me has been, like, sort of one of those really the lovely side of arranged marriage. You just sort of have this, like, mutual respect. You're not really sure what it is, and you're like, okay, well, let's try this out, I guess. And then you grow to truly love it.
Which is really kind of a best-case scenario for an arranged marriage.
Right, that's what I'm saying, the positive side of it.
All right.
The not-white slavery side of the traditional beautiful side of arranged marriage.
So in terms of arranging that metaphorical marriage, would you say that is... after writing this column in college, where you knew that you wanted to be a writer professionally, or was there even something further back, like in high school?
I've always wanted to do something with writing. In high school, I was, you know, editor of the literary magazine and that kind of thing. It's not like that stuff wasn't there, but to be frank, we live in a world where it's dangerous to say that you want to be an artist socially. The cliche for adults of, you know, but what I really want to do is direct. And every other, you know, waitress is an actor and, you know, a struggling writer, a struggling artist, struggling dancer. And so the dime a dozen factor, people are really cynical about it. And they are so quick to crush that. And you want to be protective of it if you really want it. So you don't walk around saying you want to be a writer as much. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's definitely, I don't think that's a matter of my opinion. I think that's really just true. Like, if I said I wanted to be a doctor, you would want to know what steps I was taking to become a doctor. What is my specialty? You know, it's just sort of, and you assume I have a basic skill set in science that will allow me to do that. Whereas if you say you want to be an artist of any kind, people assume you have none of those things. So it's sort of a tough racket. So I think I did kind of secretly know, but didn't really want to articulate it that much, or wasn't really ready to do that. And I also had other interests. I mean, I wanted to study archaeology, which is funny. I just read an interview recently, which made me very, very happy. It was with Jennifer Egan, who mentioned something about originally wanting to be an anthropologist or an archaeologist. And, you know, when you're looking for signs, and I find her very, very inspiring, I think, well, maybe there's something to that. You know, you want to find out about other people's stories. You love the history of it. You love that it's sort of like, you know, maybe a fake science. And like I say, a real skill set, but one that has a sort of a coolness and an art to it.
So we've kind of figured out the writing side of it. What about the comedy side? When did you first realize that you had a talent for comedy?
That's funny. I guess the humble brag answer is I'm still waiting for it, right? Like, I feel like, I don't know. I think when you're the youngest member of your family, you're kind of a ham by accident. I don't know that many, like, shy, introverted youngest kids. I just don't. Speaking of which, I remember being, I think when I knew I was inappropriate, I knew before it was funny. I remember being around 6 or 7, and my parents, you have to also imagine the time period this is, and my parents, I wanted dinner, and dinner was not ready. And I apparently have no recollection of this, but I must have been watching the news with my dad, and I hadn't heard enough phrasing from my parents. Around 6 years old, I, like, flung myself on the bed, and I said, I should go to Ethiopia and be with my own kind. And so, you know, my parents just sort of looked at each other like, I don't know what to do with this. And, you know, I think that there's, comedy comes from different places for different people. I think the most common one is a defense mechanism, maybe followed shortly by an attention getter. And then for me, I think it's how I communicate. I don't think, I mean, you'd have to replay this, but I don't know how many analogies have come out in the past, you know, 10 minutes, but probably I'm thinking a dozen. That's sort of how I speak and how I talk. So in a way, you know, if you took it out, it would be like, you know, like if I was Italian and sat on my hands and you asked me to talk. It'd be difficult. That's how I express myself, I think.
And would you say you have any real distinct comedic influences?
Writing-wise, there's so many of them. I don't know where to be. John Updike is secretly funny, and Laurie Moore is secretly funny, even though these people write completely depressing things. You know, currently, also like older satire, but currently, my gosh, it's Ian Frazier. Currently is the mad genius. Also because speaking of someone who has the skill set to know about a topic such as, let's say, Russia and Siberia, and then also to just be so breathtakingly funny, Sam Lipsight, David Rykoff, Jeff Dyer is hilarious. I don't know, Megan Dom I still think is really funny. And then in terms of, like, stand-up, you know, most stand-up comedians are funny on some level, whether you're laughing with them or at them, in terms of that kind of format. And then, I don't know, maybe these days I just sort of get my kicks from internet videos. That's it.
Which is totally acceptable. Internet videos have a lot of kicks.
Totally logical.
Yeah. When you mentioned Ian Frazier, I was actually at the Thurber Prize Acceptance Center for him this year.
Of course, because you guys are in Columbus.
Yeah, it's a huge advantage, we asked.
Yeah.
But for that, he read a little bit from his trip, the comedic memoir he did of his trip. And I noticed that you had a really similar one in your
essay
collection.
Wait, his trip to where?
His trip to Siberia.
Oh, okay. I mean, because I read that stuff, it's not that funny, but I mean, he's hilarious. I think he's hilarious, but maybe I'm thinking of something else. Sometimes his Siberian stuff is drier, but sorry, go ahead.
He may have read one of the funnier ones.
Maybe he read, what I didn't read. Sorry.
It definitely had people laughing in the room, so now I'm wondering if he had presented that as like a dramatic reading and everyone completely, completely misunderstood it.
Call me Ishmael, it's a riot. But yes, I'm sorry,
But I thought that was interesting that you list him as one of your influences, and one of your essays in this collection is from your trip to Portugal.
Oh, it's so funny. I mean, it is, and I'm happy to talk about that essay, but he also, I meant he, his travel writing, I didn't even know he did travel writing. I mean, I did kind of. He wrote, you know, On the Res and a lot about Native American reservations. And again, not that stuff tends to be not that funny, but he wrote a series of short stories and essays in a collection called Dating Your Mom. I think it's called Dating Your Mom.
Yeah. Or How to Date Your Mom, something along
those lines. Yeah, it's just so funny. It's just breathtakingly, hilariously funny, but it doesn't have anything to do with the travel writing. But yeah, there's more. There's definitely more travel writing in this, and I wonder if his compulsion, though perhaps more successfully executed, is the same as mine, which is simply that you can only gaze at your navel for so long. You kind of want to take yourself up for a spin and see if you can't apply that interest to the rest of the world, which is inevitably and infinitely more interesting than you are. And he's a perfect example of that.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with my guest, humorist Sloane Crosley, and special student host, OSU student Kevin Bauer. More information about Sloane, including links to her books, is available at www.writerstalk.org. Now back to the discussion of how Sloane chooses vacation destinations.
You actually spun the globe and put your finger down and followed through and went to Lisbon. A lot of people would do that, and then they would land their finger down and then think, oh, man, that would have been really cool, but too bad this is just a daydream.
Well, I have rules for myself. I mean, that's the thing, is it's like there's no point in applying rules if you're not going to go ahead and play the game. I said, okay, I'm going to spin the globe, and no war zones, no places I had already been, no places like Paris, which would be so depressing, and no places that, like, I'm not rich. I don't know how much you think authors make, but I could probably buy you a martini. That's about it. And so, I thought, you know, okay, if I hit like a weird island off the coast of Osaka, I can't go. And so I did it. And you know, when I eventually hit Lisbon, I don't know. I just went. It seems very strange now. It also seems like a touch boring because Lisbon is a place that people go. You know, on purpose, all the time. But I think that, so the challenge of that essay was, and the challenge of a lot of personal narrative, you know, narrative writing is, how do I make this not sort of, how do I not blow this out of proportion unless I'm doing that intentionally? Like, I have an essay in the new book about, like, the smells of taxi cabs, and I just wrote every detail I could think of about taxi cabs, and I did that on purpose. And Ian Frieder, actually, speaking of which, again, this isn't a direct thing, but he has essay he wrote that he read actually at the Thurber Prize nominations at the announcement ceremony in New York about hanging a shower curtain and the details of it. And it's just hilarious. And because it ends up not being about that, of course. It ends up being about something slightly different. But similarly with the Portugal essay, which is called Show Me on the Doll, it was more about, you know, being in Lisbon is not that big a deal. It's how I got there that's a big deal. So sort of challenge to convey that.
Absolutely. Is that something you would ever think about doing again?
I would do it again. There's actually a travel magazine called Afar that, you know, I get sort of mixed reactions. People have never heard of it, and they're like, oh, sure. I get the same thing with Connecticut College. People think it's UConn, or they think it's like, I don't know what they think. But yeah, Afar, it's based out of San Francisco, and they do a feature called the Spin the Globe feature, which I had no idea about. And they contacted me a few months ago, and they said, this is what we do. We spin a globe here in our offices, point to somewhere, and we send a writer there. But the catch is that we don't tell you until about 72 hours max before you have to go to the airport.
Oh, man.
So you can go anywhere. And also, so I said, yes, of course. And then they ended up, you know, I get an email that, you know, 2 weeks prior saying, by the way, you might want to get one of the malaria pills and a typhus shot. I sort of went to the doctor. I'm like, he's like, well, I don't know which shots to give you. And I was sort of giddy about the whole thing. Because obviously, I have sort of a predisposition to do this kind of thing. And I said, well, isn't this fun? And he said, not really. How to administer things to you. But it ended up being Quito, Ecuador, I went to. I think that they just got paranoid that I was going to go farther afield and you know, get bit by a mosquito. But it was amazing. And so I certainly would do it again under those circumstances. I don't think I would do it again for literally no other reason than the fact that I'm wedded to this childhood dream.
Well, that's a good reason.
Yeah, it is a good reason, but it's an expensive reason, and people have to live their lives. And that was part of my reaction for doing it. I think that's part of reaction or my impetus for doing a lot of things is that fear as you get older that you're letting go of the whole, you know, when I was a child, I put away childish things. I don't know, whatever that expression or quote is, I feel like you don't want to let go of everything, to literally throw the baby being your youth out with the bathwater, you know, where you kind of want to keep some of the things that made you you to begin with. And there's a fear, I think, as you get older that you become stuffy and you have no interest in exploring anymore.
Yeah, so it's good to keep that sense of adventure.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of basically what I'm saying. It's just, but I guess the reason why I'm sort of dancing around it is because in addition to a sense of adventure and travel, I mean, for everything. I mean, how you relate to people, how you see the world, you know, stopping and smelling the flowers and all that stuff.
In terms of relating to people, I know that you've done some publishing work, but you're also an author. Has your work as a publisher impacted the way that you approach being a professional author as well?
A professional author. It's so funny. It sounds like a professional puppeteer to me still.
Jim Hansen is a businessman.
Hello, I will be your businessman. I'm going into a business meeting. You know, it has a little bit. Not in the writing. I don't think about it when I'm writing. I just really don't think about it anymore, at least as much as I used to, because at the end of December, I finally sort of quit my day job because I managed to eke out two books with a very full-time career as I worked for Vintage Books, helping run their publicity department with, you know, this amazing sort of group of authors and group of people. And it's a real career, so it was hard to give up because I miss it, and I love the people I worked with. But it was too much. So I think it definitely helped in terms of knowing how to present a book, you know, and sort of, you know, ooh, it would be great to talk to, you know, this person in this town, you know. I mean, I feel like I know the local, you know, the Columbus Dispatch, I know, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, you end up, for the rest of my life, I'll know the names of, like, the media in every city. Weirdly, it's like, you know, baseball cards. But that doesn't have anything to do with the writing. So they were always pretty divorced, so it hasn't really had an impact, no.
It seems like you write a lot with the different journalism pieces you do and then all the essays that you write. Why choose to publish your essays as collections as opposed to publishing them electronically? It's like a blog.
You know, well, speaking of influences, there's a great Dorothy Parker quote that's, why do you write? And her answer was, for the money, dear. There's something for that, to be said for that, you know, to actually have a deadline and to think that, frankly, as wonderful as what's on the internet, and as much as I do write for the internet, or on the internet, as much as I do write online occasionally, it's not the same thing as having a book. It's just really not. It's not, it doesn't go through the same process. You don't have the same kind of editing, going over it and over it, and it doesn't feel as long format. It's not. It's simply not. I mean, people's attention spans are their screens. It's just something that's very different. I think that I tend to write things that, because they are so long, a lot of times, regardless of the internet, things that I would love to put in a magazine, but they're way too long. You know, the things I write for magazines are tops. I just finished a piece for Playboy that is 4,000 words, and that's very long. I mean, unless you're writing for The New Yorker and you're Cy Hirsch, it's pretty tough to come by that kind of real estate. And so if I'm writing an 11,000-word essay, I'm going to keep it to myself. And then we'll see, you know, maybe someone will excerpt it or something like that. But that's actually, you know, I mean, the internet answer is for the money, dear, and the sort of, you know, periodical answer is much loftier than that, which is just that I want to write it in the format I want to write it in, and I don't want to have to bend too much out of the gate by being constrained by 2,500 words or GQ. If that makes sense.
Well, plus there has to be a certain thrill to knowing that you can walk into a Borders in Sandusky, Ohio, and see, like, your printed work.
Yeah, I guess that's what I mean about that. Yeah, it's totally thrilling. It doesn't even feel. Sometimes it doesn't feel like me, you know, when you see your name. Just so silly. Especially working for, having had the day job I had for so long. I worked at, you know, at Random House for about 10 years, and I worked at HarperCollins for a year before that, and a literary agency for a year before that. And being so firmly behind the scenes, you know, those people are authors to me. And Weege Dandekat is an author. You know, Dave Eggers is an author. And it seems very, very ridiculous, and it is frankly ridiculous to think of myself in the same breath, and I'm not. But the truth is that if you look up a list of the books and borders in the same point size font, it's going to say my name, you know?
Yeah.
That's weird.
A lot of interviews that I've read or listened to with you about how did you get this number call you out for the lack of a question mark in the title.
Oh, everyone's so mad.
I'm not going to call you out for that. I actually think it's a really cool choice, and I'm glad that you chose to leave it out.
Oh, thank you.
I listened to one interview where you spoke about the reasons you chose not to include the question mark, and I thought the answer was really cool. It seems like you've respectfully disagreed with conventional punctuation to better suit the tone you want to convey.
Yes, that's actually more articulate than I think what I said, probably.
Oh, man, thank you. I tried to condense it down a little bit. And is that kind of writing technique something you'd like to see more for writers, kind of freeing themselves from traditional use of grammar, punctuation?
Well, I mean, there's lots of people that do that. You know, famous poets and things like that, or people who use the sort of em-dash before dialogue instead of quotations, or long-running sentences. Or, you know, if you ever read The Rules of Attraction by, you know, Brett Ellis, he just stops in the middle of a sentence that's, you know, an 18-foot-long paragraph. You know, Irvine Welsh has some intentionally illegible work that he does that's sort of very experimental and funky. But I think you have to be those guys. I mean, you really have to know the rules to break them, especially when you're talking about punctuation in the English language. And, I mean, for a title that's, you know, a very short title, you know, it's like six words, it's pretty easy to make your own rules and have your own little fiefdom. But I wouldn't necessarily want to see an entire book that objects to the concept of the question mark. I think that would be a bit infuriating.
Cool. I read a few reports, too, about HBO optioning your first collection. I was told there'd be cake as a pilot. Mm-hmm. What's it like to write for the screen as opposed to writing for print? And how's your experience with TV gone so far?
I should say right off the bat that I think they're probably not going to make it. I think they're kind of stocked up on female programming, having nothing to do with me or that, or they're just the most charming, lovely liars in the world. But but I did write the pilot for it. And so I guess I'll answer your question in reverse, which is partially to say that HBO are just, they're awesome. I guess that's kind of what you would expect. But if you were a screenwriter, you know, wow, I bet HBO probably treats their people the best. Or I bet those are the smart, you know, and like, I guess that's what you would expect. But I didn't know. I mean, I just sort of lucked out in the fact that these are the people that taught me how to write, how to use Final Draft. It's like, it's kind of nice to have HBO teach you how to do that.
Do you have any advice for college students that might be listening that are interested in pursuing writing or their dreams in general, as you have?
Besides, don't drink too much. Or do you drink too much? I don't know which one.
Hey, you can say either.
Drink in a productive fashion. If you're going to drink, be really stupid. Because then you'll, you know, have a lifetime of stories. I think, you know, it's actually advice that my professor at Connecticut College, a woman named Blanche Boyd, gave me. And it's so simple, and so it sounds hokey and really dismissive. And I'm going to give you a lot of build-up to it because I really, really mean it, and because I feel like you learn all these stupid cliche things when you're nine. You know, don't judge a book by its cover, and if you love something, let it go, and all this stuff. And then you spend the rest of your life trying to figure out what that means, you know, and if, the sooner you figure out what the following means, the better. And that is that you don't have to wait to be good. I feel like when you're in college, you think, how do I crack into this? What do I do? I don't want to, you know, you have classes, you have so much to do. You're worried about biting off more than you can chew, or you're worried about imitating something else, or you're worried about how you're perceived. Like, stop it and write as well as you possibly can right now.
Awesome. That's really good advice.
The advice I would give you. I know it sounds so basic, but it's good if you try.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, too.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk for the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with our guest, humorist Sloane Crosley, and guest host, Kevin Bauer. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch some of our interviews either at www.theohiochannel.org or by checking your television listings for broadcast times. Also, signed books and interview DVDs of select Writer's Talk guests are available at the Writer's Talk section of the Ohio State University Bookstore. Join us next week for Wayne Pacelli, CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, with his new book, The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them. Until then, this is Doug Dangler from Ohio State University.
Keep writing.